Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. In this week's show, we'll be looking at the most prominent of the nation's first ladies, Eleanor Roosevelt, the eyes, ears, and legs of President Franklin Roosevelt, but who was an important figure in her own right. And after that, Henry Butterfield Ryan will comment on the idea of regime change, commonly in conversations concerning Iraq, and how such measures have worked in the past. But before we get to those subjects, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on December 7, 1941, at 7:55 a.m., the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, the U.S. naval base in Hawaii, home to the Pacific Fleet. Described by President Roosevelt as a date which will live in infamy, the attack resulted in a U.S. declaration of war against the Japanese. 3 days later, Germany and Italy declared war on the U.S., marking the nation's entry into World War II, which cost more than 400,000 American lives. The attack came as a devastating surprise, although the United States had cracked the Japanese codes and knew in November that a military attack was imminent. It was expected to be in Southeast Asia. Instead, the Japanese fleet sailed 4,000 miles through the North Pacific, undetected, managing to avoid all U.S. patrols and other ships. 6 aircraft carriers launched 351 planes, whose bombs cost the loss of over 2,400 lives, 8 battleships, 11 other warships, and a large number of military aircraft. But as the Japanese later learned, it didn't destroy U.S. naval power in the Pacific.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, continuing on our marking the anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, U.S. researchers say they have found a Japanese midget submarine sunk more than an hour before the aerial attack on Pearl Harbor. The 78-foot sub, one of 4 such vessels that led the attack on the U.S. naval fleet in Hawaii, was sunk by a Navy destroyer a few miles short of its destination. It may have been the first shots fired in the encounter, but no connection was made between that action and the impending bombing. The remains of 2 Japanese crewmen are believed to be still inside the submarine. And Japan's secret plans to build its own atomic bomb have been made public. They include crude diagrams and written records of the 6-year effort, which some historians claim indicate that Japan was only days away from testing an atomic weapon when the U.S. dropped its first atomic bomb on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. This is Talking History.
I had done a number of things which perhaps were different from what other women in the White House had done, because of the difference in circumstances.
Eleanor Roosevelt remains the most prominent and controversial First Lady in American history, the First Lady against whom many others have been measured, most notably Hillary Clinton. Talking History's Eileen Dugan, professor of history at Creighton University, recently investigated the facts of Eleanor Roosevelt's life and the public's memory of her with Alita Black.
When we think of a president's wife, certain images often come to mind, of Jacqueline Kennedy giving her TV tour of the White House, or Nancy Reagan standing close to her husband's side, looking at him adoringly as he gave his speeches, Hillary Clinton battling with the media, or Laura Bush telling us that it's going to be okay. And then there was Eleanor Roosevelt. Our memories now of her tend to be in grainy black and white. We're always told that she was a great lady, but we often assume that it was merely because she was FDR's wife. But who was Eleanor Roosevelt? What made her revered not only as a First Lady, but as a citizen of the world? With us today to examine the public life of Eleanor Roosevelt is Dr. Alita Black, director and editor of the Eleanor Roosevelt Papers at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Dr. Black.
Hello, Eileen. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. What tends to be the public memory of Eleanor Roosevelt?
Well, I think it's very polarized. People either adore her and think that she is as close to an American saint as we will ever have, or she is the personification of everything that's wrong with what some people think of as mushy-headed liberalism. So I wouldn't say that there's one distinct image of Eleanor other than to say that everybody understands she was powerful. Nobody really knows what she did.
And what do we base our opinion of her upon?
Well, I think it comes from several factors. First is what we've now begun to see is is the way she contributed to FDR's administration. There's the statue of her in Riverside Park. There's the statue of her in the FDR Memorial in Washington, D.C. So she's beginning, you know, to pop up into American popular culture, if you will. She's even in the Broadway show in the movie Annie. She's had her own PBS American Experience documentary. She's had her own made-for-TV docudrama, if you will. And what we see is this woman with this huge heart, this infinite commitment to make America better, who just goes out in sort of a mythic way to heal the country. And so that image, I think, is indelible in our psyches. We just don't really know what it means.
How would you describe Eleanor Roosevelt before she married FDR?
Boy, what a great question. I would say she was profoundly curious, that she was battling fear and already forming her own concept of courage, that she had a clear understanding that she must make a contribution to her community. She just wasn't sure in what area that contribution should be made, whether she should be a history teacher in Allenswood Academy, the school that she attended, whether she should work in settlement communities, or whether she should focus her life specifically on sort of the noblesse oblige that the Roosevelt family had followed for generations.
When did she become involved in politics or in public service?
Well, public service I would trace back really to her high school years at the Allenswood Academy in London. Eleanor writes later that when she was 5 years old, she began to have some taste of public service when her father and her uncle, who was President Theodore Roosevelt, would take her to holiday dinners where they would serve the orphaned and the poor newspaper carriers. But I think seriously in her own right, she really became involved in when she was 16 and when she was 17, as she began to travel Europe with her great teacher, Marie Souvestre, and they began to explore settlement communities and different political groups in Europe.
How did, after she married FDR, how did his entry into politics affect her political activities?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because in many ways his entry into politics curtailed her political activities in some arenas and catapulted her activities into other arenas. So Eleanor had her own political convictions and her own political commitments before FDR entered politics. She did not actively engage in Democratic Party politics until FDR did. But before that, if you look at politics as a way to work with immigrants, to work with sanitation issues, to work with health care and child labor and the living wage, Eleanor definitely was political before FDR. What FDR's entrance into her life did was give her a new arena in which to apply those skills. And she does that quite well until she begins to have children. And then, as she says herself, in 10 years, in the first 10 years of her marriage, she was either recovering from having a child or about to have another one. And so her political activities are curtailed somewhat. But then she begins to become political with an amazing amount of energy that was there before FDR got polio.
And what did she do after he contracted polio?
Well, she not only helped facilitate FDR's recovery, but to keep his spirits up, she also began to create a new life for herself in the process, because she was able to find her own voice in a way that changed the dynamic of FDR and his mother and his wife, if you will, and was able to speak for FDR out in the communities while behind the scenes exerting her own significant influence on the way the Democratic Party in New York State was organized, in the way that labor unions operated, in the way that reform organizations communicated with one another or turned their backs on one another. And perhaps I think the biggest example of this is in the area of foreign policy when Eleanor was asked to chair the Bach Peace Prize Committee in 1924. Now, this was an international competition to sort of design a replacement for the League of Nations, which we now know as the UN. But Eleanor was such a well-known figure in her own right that she was asked to co-chair this international competition. She testifies before Congress on this issue, and this is not an FDR issue. This is an Eleanor issue. So she really is very much a political heavy hitter in her own right.
And one of the interesting aspects, I think, about her is how she was able to latch on to the media to get out her message. How did she use, for example, newspaper and radio to advance her causes?
Well, she was brilliant, I think, because not only was she a subject, she was a participant. I mean, Eleanor always defined herself as a journalist, and she proudly carried her Newspaper Guild union card in her wallet until her death. So she used media because she was a columnist, and she did not use ghostwriters. She wrote her own columns, whether it was the My Day column of the White House years, or whether it which ran 6 days a week, or whether it was a monthly question and answer column in one magazine, or editing the Democratic Party newspapers, newsletters for both the state and the national committees. She had her own radio show. And before there was public television, Eleanor works in the 1950s on education television broadcast out of Brandeis University, where she does Prospects of Mankind, her own public interest interview show, if you will. So she was a master of the media because she was both a subject of the media, but she also, as a journalist, helped construct her own image for the public. And if the media got something wrong, especially after the White House years, she was not shy in the least about correcting them.
So how unusual was it for a politician's wife to be so prominent in the media?
Well, that's very unusual. There were other politicians' wives who certainly got a lot of coverage, but there was not another politician's wife that was such an active journalist in her own right. So she was definitely one of the kind there.
How did her work contribute to FDR's campaigns for a political office, for example, for governor or for president?
Well, in 1928, when FDR is running for governor of New York for the first time, Al Smith writes this great letter to Val Moskowitz, and Al Smith was the Democratic nominee for president that year and was also the outgoing governor of New York. And he tells his key aide that one of the reasons that we have to have FDR this year is that his wife is more well-known among the party faithful than any Democratic operative in the state. So she played a huge role in organizing upstate New York, which is traditionally Republican, for the Democratic ticket in 1928 and really helped turn out record numbers of votes for FDR. And then in 1932, while she did not campaign in front of the cameras, if you will, she played a key role behind the scenes in helping organize women Democratic precinct officials, if you will, or party leaders or activists to really get the Roosevelt message out. And in 1940 and in 1944, she played key roles in really saying to FDR that you are going to have to campaign. You can't take this for granted at all. And if I could jump backwards a little bit, in 1936, she worked closely with Molly Dewson, who was head of the Women's Division of the Democratic National Committee, to really organize women to get out to help turn out what was a landslide victory for the Roosevelt ticket.
What were Eleanor Roosevelt's activities while FDR was president?
Oh, boy, we could talk for 10 years about that. She continued her My Day columns. She wrote several books. She toured the country, not only as an active observer for FDR, but as a critical observer, an astute observer, if you will, of New Deal policies to see how they worked and how they didn't work. She served as an ombudsman to bring people to FDR whose opinion she thought he should really hear for himself. She was the driving force in the White House to create the National Youth Administration and the Federal One programs, which are the Federal Writers Projects, the Arts Projects. She was a major champion of housing reform in the Roosevelt White House, as you know from her work in the Arthurdale communities in West Virginia. And throughout the war, she played a key role in different civil defense organizations and also in creating the Fair Employment Practices Commission, which abolished discrimination on race in the defense industries.
How did the Roosevelts respond to Pearl Harbor? And we know the Day That Will Live in Infamy speech, but how else did they respond to it?
This is my favorite story. And it's December 7th, 1941. Pearl Harbor has been bombed, and Eleanor has a regularly scheduled radio broadcast that night. And so the first voice that the nation hears from the White House on Pearl Harbor is Eleanor's. And she gives an unscripted, completely off-the-cuff, impassioned address to the nation the night of December 7th, talking about fear and living in a time when we suspected something like this might happen and what our responsibilities are now and what, as citizens of the world, and what our responsibilities are as citizens to America. So Eleanor really plays a key role in helping shape FDR to women and to young people and to her radio audience the day before FDR gives his great Date of Infamy speech in Congress.
What did Eleanor Roosevelt do after her husband's death? What were her activities?
Well, she was appointed to be a member of the first delegation to the United Nations by Harry Truman. And as a member of that delegation, she helped shape the refugee policies of the United Nations. She was one of the principal architects of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. She joined the board of the NAACP. She was an active campaigner for Democratic candidates. She wrote a variety of books on specific issues, whether it's on the United Nations or whether it's on India and the Awakening East or etiquette, or two autobiographies or books on substantive public policy issues. She was a whirlwind of activity.
And she was also involved in civil rights
absolutely.
Well, right?
Absolutely. Eleanor Roosevelt had one of the largest FBI files in American history, and about 90% of that relates to her positions on racial issues. As I said earlier, she was on the board of the NAACP, but she also spoke out passionately and with intense conviction on racial justice issues in the United States. And by the middle of World War II, she is saying democracy may fade or grow as we face this problem. By 1956, after the Brown decision, she will say we are all on trial to show what democracy means. And there is no domestic issue to which Eleanor Roosevelt dedicated more of her life after the White House than civil rights. And this conviction elicited several assassination attempts on Eleanor, and the Ku Klux Klan placed the largest bounty in its history on her head.
Wow. We only have a moment remaining, but what would you consider to be Eleanor Roosevelt's legacy?
Courage.
Very simply put.
That's it. Because she had the absolute strength of conviction to believe that democracy would never be perfect, but it was the last best hope, and that we were all on trial to show what democracy means. And so she risked her life, her money, her reputation, and her health to do that.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Black.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We have been talking with Dr. Alida Black, director and editor of the Eleanor Roosevelt Papers at George Washington University in Washington, D.C.
Much of what you did was done as a symbol of what the White House meant to the country. It represented the people's house, where they, as a whole, as a nation, dispensed hospitality to foreigners, to Americans of note, and your life, at least the formal part of your life, became something a little outside of yourself.
Welcome back to Talking History, continuing on the subject of our interview. For our site of the week, Joey Skidmore calls to your attention Eleanor Roosevelt's home, a National Historic Site.
Located in Hyde Park, New York, Valkill Cottage is the only National Historic Site dedicated to a First Lady. Eleanor Roosevelt once told a friend, "The greatest thing I've learned is how good it is to come home again," and Valkill was the only home she ever owned. While she was First Lady, she entertained many national and international dignitaries in its lovely rooms and gardens. But although she looked forward to a quiet retirement at Valkill when she retired, after her husband's death, she assumed a series of public roles, serving her country and the United Nations, that seldom afforded her the opportunity to spend much time there. Eleanor Roosevelt died in 1962. Her house was made over into four rental units, and in 1970 the property was sold to private developers who planned to build on the land. The Department of the Interior intervened, however, and in 1977, President Jimmy Carter made the Valkill a National Historic Site in order to commemorate for the education, inspiration, and benefit of present and future generations, Carter explained, the life and work of an outstanding woman in American history. Valkill is located in Hyde Park, New York, north of New York City.
We'd also like to call to your attention a new museum exhibit not far from Hyde Park in New York City. President Abraham Lincoln once commented that he thought Harriet Beecher Stowe's novel caused the Civil War. That might have been an exaggeration, but we dare not minimize its impact on anti-slavery sentiment on the eve of that war. Neither should we overlook its subsequent influence on the creation of stereotypical characters in American popular culture, like Uncle Tom. To celebrate the 150th anniversary of the novel's publication, the New York Historical Society is featuring Reading Uncle Tom's Image. The exhibit explores the history of the novel from its publication to the use today of its main character's name as an insult. Included in the exhibit are original editions of the novel, period illustrations, playbills from its stage renderings, and comments on the book by major American figures over the past 150 years. Reading Uncle Tom's Image at the New York Historical Society closes February 9th.
They tell me Joe Turner, he done come. Oh, they tell me Joe Turner, he done come. Come with 40 links of chain.
Finally, we turn to our commentary of the week. The idea of toppling and replacing the leader of a nation because of the threat he or she is perceived to pose has become the subject of considerable conversation lately, most notably in the case of Iraq. As Henry Butterfield Ryan reports, regime change is not a new idea. It's been tried before, with interesting results.
Regime change is a new term for an old kind of intervention, the kind President Bush has in mind for Iraq and its unsavory leader Saddam Hussein. It consists of toppling a regime that displeases or worries Washington. Since World War II, there have been at least four classic cases: the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran in 1953, of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954, of Ngo Dinh Diem in Vietnam in 1963, and of Salvador Allende in Chile in 1973. But regime change can backfire. We hear constantly that Iraq is ripe for revolution. This notion, promoted largely by exiles, brings to mind our disastrous attempt to invade Cuba with an exile army 40 years ago. Our leaders believed the Cuban people would rise up to help, but they did not. Similarly, the Iraqis may well prefer the devil they know to American, mostly Christian, invaders. Even worse, invaders allied with Britain, the former colonial ruler. Surely some Iraqis will help, but we can't assume they will be numerous enough to assist greatly. Regime changes have required tiny amounts of U.S. resources. In Guatemala, a few armed exiles. In Iran, Vietnam, and Chile, covert support for regime opponents. But one case, the overthrow of Diem, began our descent into the hellish quagmire of the Vietnam War, which grew into a disastrous conflict that still haunts the Pentagon. This time, we are told, we will smash the enemy with a massive first assault. But even if that succeeds, can we establish democracy in Iraq? Nothing has prepared it for the enormous social changes required. Guarantees of free expression and individual rights, protection of private property, the rule of law, a willingness to make political compromises, and to accept the outcome of free elections. Opposition leaders will probably want us to help with entirely different agendas, such as settling old tribal and religious scores, or helping the Kurds get their own country with a slice out of our NATO ally, Turkey. Building democracy in Iraq will demand great staying power. Nothing in our regime change history indicates that we possess that. In fact, we have left the countries in question worse off than we found them. We turned Iran over to Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, who ran so vicious and unpopular a regime the country was ripe for the Ayatollah's revolution in 1978. Guatemala entered decades of violence after we threw out our bends. Vietnam saw 12 years of brutal warfare after Diem's overthrow, and Chile suffered the despicable rule of General Augusto Pinochet after Allende was deposed. Changing regimes has left America worse off as well. Reaction to the Vietnam War caused widespread violence here. Rabid anti-Americanism in Iran resulted in the hostage crisis. A U.S. ambassador in Guatemala was assassinated, and our reputation for fairness badly tarnished from our intervention there and in Chile. Regime change can cause unanticipated damage. That is something we should remember as we prepare to follow a very insular president into an uncertain military expedition for reasons seriously questioned even by his own intelligence community.
You've been listening to Henry Butterfield Ryan, a retired U.S. Foreign Service officer and an associate of Georgetown University's Institute for the Study of Diplomacy. Ryan's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Information about the OAH and Talking History is available at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.